You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is Jonathan Coe. We are at Downing College under the auspices of the English Council. They are the proprietors of a seminar that is held yearly on the contemporary British writer. And the sound which you will hear is not studio sound. We are in a dormitory at the college talking about his books. Jonathan Coe's books include The Winshaw Legacy, which was published in America by Knopf. He has written the novel The House of Sleep, which Knopf will publish as well. Now, one of the things that I notice is that while contemporary British fiction has a consistent ironic tone, its obligation remains to a kind of domestic naturalism that, at least by inclination, your books seem to subvert. And I applaud that subversion. could we talk about that at first, the extent that a comic novel now is more a wild novel, that it seems to go beyond the genial comedy, say, of Jane Austen or P.G. Woodhouse, to something that wants to disrupt?
Yeah. Well, there's always been a tension in my writing, and I think, and in my reading, between the kind of high seriousness of certain writers who are the kind of strongest in my pantheon, and also the kind of low comedy that I enjoy just as a reader. So whereas on the one hand, among my favourite writers are people like Thomas Mann and Robert Musil, who could hardly be graver, really, in the way that they write and the kind of concerns that they address. There's also one of my earliest memories, really, of reading is of being made to laugh out loud and of kind of taking a delight in words which can fly up at you from the page and provoke you into laughter. So I think from the very earliest things that I've written, there's always been a tension between comedy and seriousness. And purely comic novels, say Woodhouse, for instance, for the sake of argument, although they give me pleasure, obviously, I still find at the end of the day that there's something undernourishing about them. There's a kind of gravity of concern, which is a sort of author's obligation, I think, which is not fulfilled, not lived up to in those kind of books. So combining comedy and seriousness is very important to me and something which I've laboured hard to do in both of my last two books.
I would assume that for a whole generation of comic writers or rebellious writers, that Monty Python, to some extent, untied their hands, and that certainly by the time of a film like Brazil, which contains political indignation as well as, satire, and the ridicule of British types turns into a universal ridicule of being human. Have the comics of television and film in Britain been an influence on you?
Yeah, a very strong influence, and Monty Python is a particularly interesting case, really. I mean, I was in my early teens, I suppose, when those shows were first being aired in Britain, and they were a complete revelation to me. People of my age had never seen anything that exciting, that wild, that inventive on television, and it was a great moment. And what Monty Python indirectly led me to were some of my favourite comic novelists. I mean, it was an English teacher at school who said to me, well, if you like Monty Python, you should know about this novel, Tristram Shandy, which may have been written in the 1750s, but it does just the same things to the novel that these people are doing to television. It's a kind of deconstruction of the form, and it's self-parody. And he turned me on to the inventiveness of Laurence Sterne and also to Flann O'Brien, who, again, is, knowingly or not, his shade hangs over what the Monty Python people did.
Now, The Winshaw Legacy is designed to be a send-up at the start of the kind of country estate mystery of Agatha Christie, or The Weekend with Jeeves and Away from the Aunt of Bertie Wooster. But it rapidly changes, and when it starts to allow characters to change their gender, to reveal themselves to be peddlers in human lives, to be arms dealers, when it begins to arrive at a sort of frenzied state of invention, that's when the novel starts for me, mm-hmm. and you become the author whose next book I want to read. And yet you have said that you have a strong impulse to remain tied to the accessible, to the world which wants to understand a book on a literal level. Why? Why?
Partly this is as much to do with my temperament as a reader, I think, as my temperament as a writer, that I know what works in books for me, and I try to replicate that in what I'm writing. And although there's a theoretical level, I think, on which I can enjoy a book like Finnegan's Wake or a book like How It Is, one of, you know, to take one of Beckett's later novels, on the level of enjoyment, on the level of provoking kind of delighted responses in me as a reader, those books simply don't work. Now that's not a failing in these writers as writers. This is a failing in me as a reader, but I can only try to replicate what it is that the kind of pleasurable experiences that I've had as a reader when I sit down to write a book. So I'm concerned that the reader should feel anchored in my books, and also at least to start with to feel kind of safe, simply because, you know, I want to take the reader on a journey, and there's got to be some way of hooking them, really, and social realism is the way to do that. It's still most people's point of entry into the novel, I think.
Yes, but when you talk about Finnegan's Wake or How It Is, it's not too early to say that for most people, Finnegan's Wake is a failure. How It is the return to the novel by a writer who was sick of it. Mm. But that the early novels of Beckett, Watt, for instance, which is extreme in its pyrotechnics, is an unending source of frustration and delight, and that people who are afraid of Beckett should be advised to pick up Watt, will be so happy. They won't be able to stop laughing. Yeah. And you see, to my mind, the possibility that the kind of thing you do might arrive at the ecstasy of grotesqueness and gravitylessness of Watt makes me want to say, you know, cut the cords, you know, escape from the world. Flann O'Brien, the author of The Great At Swim Two Birds, which is not very well known in America, but by the ones to whom it is known to be the great comic novel of our time.
Yeah.
At Swim Two Birds, Dalkey Archive, The Third Policeman. Flann O'Brien is another case of a writer who might be called difficult, but to anyone who loves to read, you wouldn't need the word difficult. You'd call it fun.
Yeah. Of the two authors you've mentioned, the one I'm most likely to, the road I'm most likely to go down is the Flann O'Brien road, really. I mean, I think At Swim Two Birds, it has a lot of parodies of Irish mythology in it, for one thing, which are hard work for the reader. But at the same time, there's a very accessible and dry and amusing strain of realism in that book as well, which is in the central character who's a student, and the sort of rather squalid, rather intellectually arrogant life he lives, which on one level is one suspects slightly autobiographical in Flann O'Brien's own case, and on another level is a parody of the Joyce of Portrait of an Artist. But within that framework, Flann O'Brien includes and plays variations upon an astonishing range of styles and literary modes. And there is a sense in which I think that novel stands behind and overshadows what I was trying to do in The Winchell Legacy, which slips from voice to voice, style to style, many different forms of parody and pastiche, different kinds of writing in that book. But again, this is... I wasn't doing that for any sense of delight in language for its own sake, which I suspect is one of the things you're kind of groping for in my books. I did it because I felt that was the best way that I could draw a realistic portrait of the society I was trying to describe, which is a society which regards itself through the filter of many different kinds of media, through magazines, through cinema, through television, through its literary heritage, all those kind of things. It's no longer possible to write about, certainly my country, probably any country, purely regarding the writer as a kind of innocent window through which the reader is able to look at an entirely realistic social portrait. Reality isn't that innocent anymore. It's mediated and filtered by the press and all those other kinds of agencies, and that's the kind of fractured, second-hand, if you like, reality that I was trying to convey in The Winshaw Legacy.
I'm speaking to Jonathan Coe, whose new book is The House of Sleep. Now, you mentioned that you had originally another title for the book, which I think is lovely and would be the title of one of the kinds of books I'm talking about, yes?
Yeah. The book was originally going to be called Somniloquy, and somniloquy is a real word, it's in the dictionary, and it means a speech or an utterance made in one's sleep, and one of the characters in the book talks in her sleep, or at least we are led to believe that she talks in her sleep. Nothing really is as it seems in this book, and you have to wait. Actually, in the case of that character, you have to wait until the very last page to find out whether she really talks in her sleep or not. But I just fell in love with the word when I came across it, and was hopeful that my publishers would allow me to use it as a title, but four-syllable words and not on in today's publishing environment, unfortunately.
Well, you know, for those of us who live in the other world, you know, somnambulism, you know, I love to know what people do in their sleep and its relation to both physical worlds, the physical world of the interior of the head and the physical world of the bedroom around which one rises from bed and sleepwalks.
Yeah.
But sleepwalking does seem to be one of the modes of comedy, yes?
Well, that was the original impulse behind the book, that I used to sleepwalk myself.
You did.
And, you know, strange and, in retrospect, funny things happen when you sleepwalk. You know, once I was sharing a room with one of my student friends. I was staying in her flat for the weekend, and I tried to get into bed with her in my sleep. And you know, this is the stuff of comedy, really, of romantic farce. And so originally I more or less as a reaction against the complexity and the ambition and the political content of The Winshaw Legacy, I thought I would write a short, funny book about somnambulism and insomnia, these kinds of things.
Sleep disorders.
Yeah, but
apnea.
Yes, snoring, which is a sleep disorder I didn't manage to get into this book, unfortunately, because, you know, the same thing's there. People think it's a comic phenomenon, but marriages have broken up over sleep apnea. But as you say, you know, you don't have to think about this subject for very long to realise what a strange and serious and poetic and resonant subject it is, really. And so the book kind of ballooned out as soon as I started to write it and became more serious than I intended, which I'm very happy about. I mean, it's become the book I now realise that I wanted it to be, but it was meant to be slighter and funnier in a way.
Now, at a certain point, it seems to me, humor becomes dark and relevant when it is taken to excess. And in British humor, one of those excesses, it seems, is perversion. Joe Wharton famously takes farce there. And to some extent, it seems as if sexual inversion of various kinds, it seems very important in early Beckett that we not know that the author has sexual tastes of his own, that the only thing we know is that all sexuality is nauseating and that the outrageous forms of sexuality perhaps can be described with more elan than nausea, but nevertheless the outre is to be hoped and quested for.
Mm-hmm.
Where does this put you?
Well, I think the British are unique, certainly unique in my knowledge, in the way that they consistently, the only way we can really consistently articulate our feelings about sexuality and examine them and discuss them is through humour. There's really no serious discussion of sex in my country. It's all done through innuendo and double entendre. I mean, it always fascinates me that we had to import these words from Italy and from France to describe linguistic phenomena that don't really happen in Italy and France, and certainly not to the extent that they do in Britain. So there's, I think one of the reasons that British writing about sex is so comically fertile and inventive is precisely this kind of indirection, our refusal to come at it straight, our kind of repertoire of circumlocutions and euphemisms for activities which in any other culture are talked about with perfect frankness. That's always seemed to me a rich source of comic possibilities.
Is As that you say, why... Do you think that these couples, in so many cases, plan to kill another when what they're actually talking about is sex? Is this the secret behind the Lavender Hill mob? And
It could well be. I mean, you know, certainly the British cinema of the 40s and 50s was every bit as repressed as the American cinema of that era, even though it wasn't codified in the way that you had the Hays Code to kind of stop you talking about any of these things. We voluntarily gave up that freedom in a way and always came at things obliquely. And, you know, a lot of the plot developments that you find in those films are really, there's often a sexual undercurrent to them. That's what's really happening in the movie when you look at it. And, there always comes a point with any kind of humour where you want to take it to an extreme, and that's the point that Orton arrived at in the 1960s, which put him, you know, very much ahead of his time, really. I mean, his ideas about sex, the kind of ideas that you get in those plays, are still pretty shocking to most British people, I think.
Orton's
never really made it into the British theatrical mainstream. You don't find him produced in repertory theatres in provincial towns and that sort of thing. It's still too much to take, in a way.
It's very interesting, because in America, you know, Orton is virtually a given for a certain kind of black comedy. It's where you begin. And to some extent, in the wake of Orton, we can start to see William Burroughs as a sort of British writer, an anatomizer of comic types, except for the extremity of the language. Burroughs comes out of an English tradition of type humor, eccentricity.
Oh, that's very interesting. I've never thought of Burroughs in that way before.
I'm speaking to Jonathan Coe, the author most recently of The House of Sleep. Now, I know that in order to assess your relationship to a more experimental tradition in writing, you are writing about the British writer B.S. Johnson, who is as barely known in Britain as he is slightly more known by publication in America. Could you describe his work a bit? I've read only two books. They were published by New Directions, and I was very interested in him.
Yeah. Johnson, his writing life was short, really. It began in 1963 with the publication of his first novel, and it ended abruptly and tragically in 1973 when he killed himself. In between, he published seven novels. One was published posthumously. And he always rejected the sobriquet experimental writer, but it has to be used, I think, just as a kind of shorthand, because what he's doing is so different from anything that's coming out of mainstream British fiction at the same time, or, in fact, since. The starting point, I think, is his heavy influences from the kind of writers we've been talking about today, from Samuel Beckett, from Flann O'Brien, from James Joyce, writers who continually questioned and interrogated the nature of the act of writing fiction, what it means to invent characters and to pretend they're real, what it means to narrate a novel in a particular narrative voice. And he took those ideas in a way, although he's always remained a very funny writer and again a writer anchored in realism to a large extent, certainly a writer who wrote autobiographical fiction to a large extent, he took these methods of writing to very interesting extremes and published two or three quite fascinating books, I think. The most famous isn't the right word because it's not in print, but the most notorious and the best remembered in a way is a novel called The Unfortunates. This is a novel which he conceived of as a transcript, a literal transcript of the random activity of his mind one Saturday afternoon while he was remembering, imagining, visiting places, this kind of thing. But he absolutely rebelled against the idea that this novel should be in any kind of sequence because he thought the mind didn't work like that. It should replicate the randomness as much as possible. So what he did was to instruct his publisher, his long-suffering publisher, I have to say, the novel was in 27 sections of 4 or 5 pages each, and these sections were unbound and were presented to the reader in a box. And the reader is told that one of them is numbered 1, one of them is numbered 27, you have to read those first and last, but the others, the reader is meant to shuffle and read in any order that takes their fancy. And that was his kind of extreme solution to the problem of being faithful to the randomness of experience and remembered experience. Another technique which he did, which I love and feel ought to have wider currency, really, because it is actually a good idea. And this is in a novel called Albert Angelo, which I think is in print in the States from New Directions. There's a scene where he wants the reader to know something that's going to happen in a few pages' time. What in the movies would be called a flash forward. So you're on page 50 and he wants you to know what's going to happen on page 55. So what he does very ingeniously is to cut a hole in the pages.
Yes.
So that while you're reading page 50, you can read through into something that's going to happen in 5 pages' time. And it's a great idea and it's a solution to a technical problem which faces a lot of writers. And but he had the guts and the nerve and the sort of bloody mindedness really to make his publisher, you know, allow him to do these things.
Now I want to close with to my mind an interesting final question. I have always been jealous of the French because they can read Raymond Roussel in the original. They have Georges Perec. Mm. They have the Oulipo people,
yeah,
from whom, you know, Calvino and others descend. The novel is structure, the novel is language, the novel is machine, the novel is comedy. But for some reason, this is the road not taken in British literature because, in fact, it is preceded by Alice in Wonderland. And it has been a decision that Alice in Wonderland is not an adult book, but a children's book. Not a book of surrealism, but a book of logic, written by a mathematician. Everything that could be done to Alice has been done to make her powerless. In other words, that this is not the world of dream, this is a chess game. But it is so much at the head of Nabokov, of Georges Queneau, of anything that you might want to point to that followed, of Joyce, of everyone. Talk to me about the British, say, difficulty with the surreal, with the fantastic, and its embrace.
Mm. Well, Alice in Wonderland obviously is a great adult novel, one of the great adult novels.
One of the few great adult novels.
And a fantastic comic novel, since that's what we've been talking about on this program. You know, how do you account for the pragmatic streak in the British character? It's not just to do with the kinds of fiction we like. It's to do with the kinds of intellectual currents we're open to, because structuralism and deconstruction have never been allowed a foothold in British universities. Derrida, Lacan, Barthes are all regarded as kind of amiable cranks by the British. I think it's partly it's arrogance that a kind of suspicion of the foreign. I don't just mean that in terms of national boundaries, but in terms of mental boundaries. A suspicion of the foreign which converts itself into superiority and a sense that the British way is the best because it's firmly anchored in realism. At the same time, as we've been discussing in this program, you know, I'm of that culture. I'm as British as they come. You know, I'm British through several generations. I only speak the one language, and I'm saturated in the literature of Jane Austen and Thomas Hardy, and the films of David Lean and Carol Reed. You know, films in which novels in which emotion is often tightly reined in, or the novels are concerned with the tragic consequences of reining your emotions tightly in, and this sort of thing. So, you know, there's no escaping that from me from one point of view, and temperamentally, it's where I feel at home. But the struggle as a writer is to maintain an interrogative attitude towards that, and not to take it as a given. I think that's the danger. If you take social realism as a given, and if you take language as being purely an instrument in which to register reality in that uncomplicated kind of way, if that's your assumption, if that's your only sense of what the novel can do, then you're in trouble. If that's your sense of that that's one of the things the novel can do and perhaps should do, but you keep those other wilder, more surreal, more interesting possibilities in mind and somehow find ways of incorporating them into the book, then I think that's a kind of that's an honest and combative way of coping with your own traditions and finding your own way forward, and that's the continual struggle that I feel I'm engaged in, really, and I hope will continue to be engaged in.
I've been speaking to Jonathan Coe, the author most recently of The House of Sleep, published by Knopf, a novel which takes place in a home where sleep disorders are treated. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. I'm taping this in a dormitory room at Downing College in Cambridge, the guest of the British Council at their seminar on the contemporary British writer. This is Michael Silverblatt. Thank you again for listening to Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book, off the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.